Welcome to Season 6 of Game Design Unboxed on the No Direction Network. Danielle Reynolds talks to tabletop game designers about the games they've made. Together, they unbox how the game went from inspiration to publication.
Go check out AllPlay at SHBO, booth 5L415. For anyone who hasn't been, it's the largest board game convention in the world, and it's going on this weekend, October 23rd through 26th. And they're going to be debuting Piñatas, Three Witches, and The Networks. But don't worry, if you're not going to be there like I will, these titles will be releasing worldwide shortly after. Essen attendees will get a first chance to experience them at the expo. If you don't know what these games are, well, in Piñatas, players want to take tricks. And once you've taken three tricks, you're out of the round. It's got a simple rule set with clever scoring twists. Honestly, it delivers exactly what designer Dr. Knizia's signature blend of elegance and tension typically does. Versus Three Witches, which is a must-follow trick-taking game with no trump and a unique bidding twist. At the start of each round, players are bidding on how many tricks they think they can win. Out of five, the highest bidder becomes the lead witch. Their opponents team up as the lesser witches. Then the lead witch is going to play two cards, one face down, while the lesser witches each play one. Matching suits or ranks combine, creating tricky surprises. If the lead witch matches their bid exactly, they're going to earn two fate tokens. If not, the lesser witches each earn one. The first to collect five fate tokens is going to claim the victory. And then completely unrelated to trick-taking, we have The Networks, which is a fan favorite with now a new all-play makeover. You're going to step into the shoes of a rising TV executive, and you're going to build your media empire one show at a time. You're going to draft stars, run ads, and manage your show lineup over five seasons. Balance your cast carefully. Some thrive only on dramas, while others, you know, the spotlight alone. Keep your schedule fresh by canceling underperforming shows and play powerful network cards to shake things up. At the end, the network with the most viewers wins. Fun fact, the original printing and interview is actually a part of the podcast, so look back at the first season. Make sure to check out all these games and more out in Germany with me at the AllPlay booth. And if you can't be there, check it out online after Essenspiel. But let's get into the episode. Thank you for joining me, Danielle, for Game Design Unboxed, Inspiration to Publication, episode 126, Space Base. Today, we are joined by independent game designer, John D. Clare. Thanks for being on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I'm super pumped. And before we started recording, we already started talking about why the middle initial. I want our listeners to know a little bit more about you. Why the middle initial, but also what got you into gaming?
Well, as we discussed, the middle initial is how I signed my name. And I was also like, authors put their middle initials, right? George R. Martin, J. R. R. Tolkien. I was like, yeah, I should put the middle initial. And only after people started actually like doing reviews of my games and saying, this is designed by John D. Clare. And then they would make some joke about D. Clare. It was only after that I was like, oh yeah, that is like a pun, isn't it?
Hey, I'm not shaming you. Heck, I made up my own signature one day thinking I'd be famous, and I actually signed boxes, but everyone's like, what's that? So now I signed my full name plus the signature I made up, so I don't know why I spent the time to make the short one. So then what got you into designing games?
I was a nerdy kid. I was homeschooled. Well, first of all, I was just attracted to games to begin with. Creative endeavors and competition was a node of my interests, right? Those two things overlapped. Creation and a desire to play games and compete. So it was a sort of a natural thing. The first games I made were mazes. I loved doing mazes as a kid, both doing maze books, but then drawing my own mazes. But then I would start like really gamifying them. I would turn them into these whole like dungeon crawl mazes where you'd pick up weapons as you travel around and then go fight monsters and stuff. And then I was inspired by things in my childhood, like Pokemon, Age of Empires, to make board games more. So the first game I made that was playable and fun, I think I was 9 years old. I had made other games before then that were not playable, or at least not fun. But when I was 9, I made a game called Monster Cards, which was just a dice-chucking little monster fighting game sort of inspired by Pokemon. And that game was reasonably fun for a 9-year-old's design. So anyway, that interest just carried forward into adulthood. You know, I got a normal degree out of college.
What was the normal degree?
Economics with an emphasis in business management.
Ooh, wow. That's like a real adult degree. That wasn't, no offense to creative writing, but that's kind of where I expected it to go when you said that.
No, I got a real adult degree with the intent of having a real adult job, which I got. I had a real adult job, but nights and weekends were game design. with the goal of making money. It wasn't just like, I'll just do it because I like it. My goal was like, I know I want to get published. I want to try to supplement my real adult job income with hopefully some game design royalty and see if I can make that work. After Mystic Veil came out and then Space Base and then a few others, it just started to make sense to start doing that full time instead of the real adult job. And now I don't have a real adult job anymore and I just do game design.
You know, honestly, you were one of the first, if not the first, and once again, this is the 126th episode, that someone actually intentionally said, I started designing because I wanted to make this for money. Most people are like, oh, I just like making games, or this was a fun hobby, and then, oh my god, I actually got to switch. But you're like, no, this is a thing I'm going to do, and you made it happen. How did you make it happen?
Well, so it wasn't like I'm going to quit my job and I'm going to make it happen, right? It was, if I'm going to spend my nights and weekends doing this thing I really enjoy, I'm going to do it with the goal of trying to turn it into supplementary income. So it's not that making money had supplanted the idea of doing something I enjoy creatively because I enjoy it. But if I was going to spend a bunch of time doing this thing that I really enjoy, and that thing has the potential to translate into money, I should try to see if I can make that happen, right? My design North Star was a combination of what am I actually excited to work on? Like, even if I make a game and I'm like, I actually think this is a very marketable idea and it's pretty fun, but I don't really enjoy it. It's not really for me, but maybe I'll finish it and try to pitch it. Like, the second I don't like my game, I will either change it or scrap it. Like, if I'm just like, eh, it's okay, but I think it'll sell well, I will just move on to a different design. So that's always one of the North Stars. And then, you know, the other one is like, even if I'm really excited, I really like this game, but it has essentially 0% chance of translating into something that many people get to play because it just isn't a marketable game, it won't make me money, then I will move on from it as well.
No, that's totally fair. And I guess I should also say, when I mentioned that, it's because you are an independent designer and you pitch versus making your own games. Because people have decided to do it by making their own. Switching over the episode, we're focusing on Space Base, even though you have made many, many other games that are really cool. But for that game in particular, where did the inspiration come from for that game?
It's directly from Machi Koro.
I just played that like a week ago. That's funny.
There's no point in obfuscating that. So at the time I was hanging out, and I unfortunately don't get to anymore because he moved to the other side of the country, so I don't hang out with him as much. But I was hanging out a lot with John Zinzer, the owner of AEG, because I was working with them closely on Mystic Veil stuff. We'd made custom heroes at that point. We were working on some other bigger designs. I think we were at Board Game Geek Con, and John loved Machi Koro. And it was one of his games that, as I recall, he tried to sign. He tried to get the designers to sign with AEG. And they ended up going with somebody else, and he was always like, bah!
I think it was IDW, and then Pandasaurus kind of went with them, yeah.
I think that's right, yeah. And so he was always like, that one got away. Anyway, of course, one night, we finished the night with Machi Koro, and I was always of the opinion that Machi Koro is a brilliant design that doesn't scratch the itch for me.
Like, it was too entry level for you?
Really, yeah, really good gateway. It really shows off the mechanism in a lovely way. There was just a number of things that I'm like, for me to like this game more than just okay, there's a number of things that I think I would want differently. And then that just got my brain going, and that night I was just thinking about like, well, okay, the dice rolling is essentially from Settlers of Catan. Roll two dice, and depending on what you roll, everybody at the table maybe gets something or nothing. And Machi Koro had just basically distilled that mechanism from Settlers into a card game where it's just straight to like roll dice, get stuff from your cards, buy more cards. And I really liked that. And to me, I was like, what would I do differently? So literally just one night while I was sitting in bed after having played it at Board Game Geek Con, I sort of thought up most of the game. And there was a few core things like, rolling the dice, on your own turn, you should never get nothing. So, like, I had too many experiences with Machi Koro where there's just, like, three rounds of the game early where I just don't hit anything. I literally don't make a choice on my first three whole rounds of the game just due to bad dice luck, right? And I was like, that just shouldn't happen, right? Like, I get it's a dice game. There's going to be plenty of luck, right? But we should avoid, like, having nothing turns. So I was like, okay, you should always get stuff on your own turn, and then maybe get stuff on other people's turns, right? So that sort of then translated into this idea of this board where every single possible roll gives you something on your own board, but then you get as you buy cards, you gradually get abilities that trigger on other people's turns. The other core conceit was, I want there to be a decision on the die roll to an extent. Like, I want the probability distribution to not just be your typical two die, seven in the middle, you know, two and 12 on the ends. And I want there to be sort of maybe a choice after you roll. Like you roll and you can decide whether you take the sum of the dice or the individual dice. Having come up with that, I'm like, well, that creates a really interesting probability spectrum, because then the two through six are actually the most likely numbers to be rolled, right? The six being the most likely, and then 5, 4, 3, 2, and then 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. And that creates a sort of a design space that's actually more dynamic than just your typical seven at the top and everything sort of pyramiding down from there. All of that kind of came together in my head one night. After the con, I came home. I think it was the Monday after the convention back at home. I just drafted up sort of just a black and white, really basic prototype. Printed it out, cut it out, and tried it with Sheila, my girlfriend at the time, my wife now. Seemed like it worked pretty well. I think I was playtesting with the AEG folks a few days later, so I tweaked a handful of cards. I didn't change any core rules. I just tweaked a handful of cards and rebalanced and played it with them, and they were like, this is great. So, amazingly, this has never happened before and will probably never happen again in any design I work on, but not a single core rule changed. And I mean core rule. Not a single rule changed from the initial draft to the final game, other than like card balancing and like resource, like starting resources on your turn, stuff like that, right? Like really basic rules. Like all of the important rules, amazingly, came out of my head working really well. And I say that has never happened before and will never happen again. And that's probably true. Because
damn, yeah, I would not have guessed that.
Right, even when I described to other designers like you, most people are like, yeah, that never happens.
No, I'm actually surprised. I would have assumed it has happened more than once to you. I guess I'm on the other side of this coin, because that tends to happen with most of my games.
Like, see, there you go.
The base rules are like solid from my initial like notebook writings. Very little changes. It's more just the tweaking of numbers and cards and components, but the core of it tends to be pretty solid at this point.
As I have gotten better as a game designer, my initial prototypes are closer to like a working game than they used to be. I can get straight to like a, is this game fun rather than does this game work, much quicker. And obviously the complexity of the game factors into that significantly, right? When I'm designing games on the easier end of the spectrum, it's a lot quicker to go from initial idea to finished rule set than a heavier strategy game. But no, I've Space Base is my one and only experience of just sort of like it all coming together and then just working and not needing changes.
Yeah. So what made you decide on the space theme for it? Or did you have a different theme at the time?
I had a different theme, which I still reminisce. And my original theme was called City of Angels, and it was going to be about Los Angeles. If your audience is familiar with Space Base, right, you've got that player board in front of you that goes from 1 to 12. My vision of it was that would be like a panorama of Los Angeles from the beach to the mountains, and the different spots in there would be, you'd have like some high-rise buildings, you'd have some like regional, so it would be like a panorama of Los Angeles. And your starting cards are all just sort of like Los Angeles in its early days. And as you buy cards, the cards all represent landmarks in LA, like Dodger Stadium could be a card, and it could be like an 11 or 12, right? And you put it onto your board, and it goes in the spot because it has to go in that spot. It goes where Dodger Stadium goes, because we can sort of preset it, right? The pier will always go in the one spot because it's at the beach, and it's a one-sector card. And obviously, some weird abilities could cause it to change, so you end up with a weird LA where, you know, part of downtown is, you know, in the middle of Culver City.
I was going to say, I was like, do you guys get earthquakes?
Yeah, exactly. Right. But I like that. And then as the cards stack, you kind of get, like, this topography to LA. That was my original idea, and then my thought was, like, we could make other iterations of, like, different cities. The folks at AEG decided that a game clearly inspired, sort of explicitly inspired by Machikoro, which is a town building, city building game, maybe shouldn't also be a town city building game. And then we were just bouncing names off, and someone was like, maybe it should be a game about building a base in space. And somebody was like, we should call it Space Base. And then that just sort of stuck.
It's not a bad name, but that totally makes sense why they went that direction. I would agree that was probably at the time a good choice, even though I would totally buy your version. And so because you came up with this idea and you just happened to be with the AEG people at the time, did they offer you a contract, or were you currently designing for them? Like, how did that partnership happen?
I was technically independent at the time. We had sort of negotiated a semi-exclusive deal at the time. So it sort of fit into that. They were essentially getting a first writer refusal for my designs, with me getting paid like a bonus development amount on it. So it didn't have to end up with AEG, but they got the first pitch, they really liked it, and it went from there.
And you were actually going to get paid to develop, which is quite rare. Sounds like it's worked out really well.
They've been great to work with. John's a great guy. The folks there are smart and talented. As with anyone you would work with this much, I have my thoughts on the ways they could do things better. I think they have strengths and weaknesses, but they're great. I intend to keep on working with them on projects that make sense to do with them. So, and I've got 3 in the pipeline with them right now.
I know. We keep joking. We're like, I think, do you own them or do they own you? So many of your games come from them. It's so funny.
It's been a little while since they've released one of mine, though. I've had these 3 in the pipeline with them for a while. 2 of them are kind of going to hit back to back now, even though they were designed on different timelines. Just that's how things go sometimes.
Oh yeah, I'm sure like things like tariffs and stuff affected their timelines, like many people's.
That is exactly part of it, yeah.
Yeah, I know the feels. But for the game, so the core rules were set. You kind of talked about it. Mind talking a little bit more about the cards and how they work, just for people who haven't played?
You have a player board that ranges from 1 to 12, which are the possible rolls. And a lot of people go, wait a second, how do you roll a 1 with 2d6? So again, one of the important concepts of Space Base is after the roll of 2d6, you can choose to either get the reward for the sum of the dice, or get both of the rewards for the individual dice. So therefore, 1s are possible. And of course, as mentioned, it also means that the 6 is the most likely thing to be rolled, because it can get rolled on either of the 2 individual dice, or it's the most likely of the 1 through 6 to get rolled as the sum of the dice. Which makes, like I said, this interesting probability curve where the 1 through 6 are all roughly equal in power and probability, and then the 7 is much more powerful than them because it's much less likely to get rolled, and then increasing from there where the 12 is very unlikely to be rolled, and therefore I can put really awesome epic powers on it. So the way the cards all work, the cards themselves are sort of 2 parts. They have a blue ability, which is the bonus you get when that card is on your player board and you're the one who rolled the dice. And then they have a portion of the card that is red at the very bottom of the card, and it's upside down to you when that card is face up on your board. But whenever you buy a card, a new card from the market, that card will tell you what sector it goes in. So if I buy, say, a 9-sector card, I have to put it in my 9-sector on my board. The card that's already in my 9-sector is removed from the board, turned around upside down so that little red bit at the bottom is now face up to me, and then tucked back into the board beneath the 9-sector. Sort of tucking, so just sort of like popping out above the board at the 9-sector spot. And the new card I just bought goes into the 9. So now I have a new power whenever I roll a 9, but that power that I just tucked in the 9 spot above my board is now something that I will get every time an opponent rolls a 9. So not only did I ideally improve the ability that I get from my 9 sector when I roll a 9, I've now added an ability I get whenever somebody else rolls a 9. And then crucially, if I were to buy another 9 sector card, I would repeat the process. I would do that again. So the card that the cool card I bought previously in the 9 now becomes a second tucked card in the 9 sector. So now I have 2 abilities I get whenever an opponent rolls a 9. And this stacking has no limit, right? So as long as I keep buying cards in the same sector, I will keep stacking that, and I'll have this epic payoff when someone else rolls a 9. There's this flow of the game where early on you always get stuff on your own rolls. So your own turn is where you're getting most of your income. But it very quickly, as every time you buy a card, you create a new ability that you get from when other people roll. So very quickly, as the game progresses, you actually start generating more or at least as much stuff on other people's rolls. And by the end, other people's turns are actually benefiting you a lot more than your own turn. And then one of the most fun things that I did in the game, and I really leaned into it in the latest expansion, is there's cards in the game that have arrows. So one of the important things for me in the design was to create the ability to sort of mitigate your luck, right? Or give yourself luck advantages, let's say. Because I felt like that was one of the things from Machikoro that I wish the game had done more of as a gamer who wants a little bit more control in his crazy dice luck game. I introduced a number of card effects that would give you a little bit ability to manipulate the dice. It's kind of a spatial manipulation almost, because your board is this 1 through 12 board. So what I did, I made cards that are these, they're called like double arrow cards. And the ability of the card shows just an arrow pointing to the left and an arrow pointing to the right, with an or slash in between them. Whenever you get that ability, instead of that ability giving you something, you get the ability that it's pointing at. like a common epic thing you can build in Space Base is where you like have a series of arrow chains. Maybe you've got an arrow on the 8, the 9, and the 10, all pointing at your 11 sector where you've stacked a ton of powers. And now all of a sudden, anytime a 8, 9, 10, or 11 is rolled, you power off your giant epic thing. And it takes multiple turns. It takes a bunch of the game to sort of build that up. But the payoff is really satisfying when you get there.
Oh, yeah. No, my friend Steph did that against me. I actually played Space Base with the expansion as my first time of ever playing. Okay. So, yeah, I got wrecked. But I had a lot of fun, though, because I do agree that it was really cool to be able to take the parts that I had learned years earlier from Machu Koro, and I feel like it fixed a lot of the problems I had with it, including even some of the, like, negative cards in Machu Koro. I feel like it'd be in an infinite loop if we all took them and all rolled that same number. That just got frustrating, and I feel like I didn't experience that while playing Space Base.
Yeah, I hesitate to use the word fixed, because there's plenty of people who prefer Machu Koro.
I guess for me, also, liking occasional heavier games.
I think for a lot of gamers, Space Base scratches the strategy itch in the midst of its dice luck chucking, whereas Machu Koro feels a little bit more luck dependent, a little more out of your control, which for casual gamers works fine a lot of the time. People who aren't there to try to min-max the engine, they're just there to have a good time. But us gamers, we want to min-max the engine, right? We want to feel like every choice we made sense strategically, and not just was like, hey, I hope it pays off, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no. I love what they did with the Legacy version, which I will not talk about because I'd be spoiling it. So
I haven't actually played it.
Yeah, it's good. I have not finished it because I've literally never finished any Legacy game. I think I'm cursed, and no one should ever start a Legacy game with me if they want to stay friends with me. But okay, so then beyond that, you also added victory points and other ways to win. Why don't you go through just like what a person's turn looks like and how to win the game?
This is one of the things, I got this question, the answer is actually kind of funny. The way the game ends, one player gets to 40 victory points, at which point you just finish the turn until even turns. Everyone's had the same number of turns. And then whoever's the most points wins, which is usually the person who got to 40 first, but it's possible in those last like couple turns to finish the round, someone was able to get a bunch of points and catch them. It's essentially first to 40, as long as you can hold it on for the last turn. And people, I remember someone asked me, it was like, how'd you pick 40? Like, what other numbers did you try before you decided on 40? I mean, the answer is, I had picked a card size that I wanted. I was like, I want these sort of narrower cards because I need to fit 12 of them in front of you. What's the maximum size of this board that I like? I don't want it to be like too long. So like, okay, so this is about the size. I can fit 12 cards if you make them this narrow. And then I'm like, okay, well, I got 10 millimeter cubes to put on the trackers. Like, what's the maximum number of spaces I can put on this track with 10 millimeter cubes? And I was like, okay, well, it's 40. So I guess we'll make the track to 40 and see how that works. So the track started at 40 because that's what fit on the player board at 10 millimeter cubes. And I tried it and I was like, yeah, that seems about right.
It's cat logic. If me fits, me sits. Done. Yeah. Ship it.
That's right.
That's honestly probably what I would do.
Yeah, that's one of the things that that usually doesn't happen in game design. Like, it's true that I will sort of gut pick some number. Like, you have to come up with rules for how your game ends at some point, right? You have to, like, I don't know, play to 20 points and, you know, whatever, right? And then at some point you're like, okay, that's a little faster than I want it to be, or it's a little slower than I want it to be, or I don't like that end game condition, let's change it to something else, right? But not in this case. I was like, 40 is what fits on the board, let's try and see if it works. I was like, okay, never. I just in the development process never found a reason to do something different. It's like, all right, yeah, good enough.
Cool. And then since you do work a lot with AEG and you do development as well on your own games, do you also get opinions on like art and graphic design and like rule book writing and like that kind of stuff too? Like, how involved do you get to be in these games?
It's sort of to the extent that I feel I want to and am going to spend my sort of designer capital trying to get what I want. Because obviously there's a lot of opinions. I don't get final say. If I want it to, I maybe could. How much of a stickler and a hard-to-work-with person do you want to be to get your way on little things or big things, right? Depends on how important I feel it is. So usually I will express my opinion and then defer to the publisher if they disagree on things like art and graphic design. But generally, I mean, AEG has always been very receptive to my opinions. you know, if I express a strong opinion on something, they're usually not like, you're wrong. On Space Base in particular, I was not super involved just by choice on the art choices and direction. I think I would have been more so had the theme been something that excited me more. I agree with you that the name Space Base is actually a great name. I think the theme is super bland, personally, and the sort of tableau of little ships that all look kind of the same is a somewhat meaningless additional experience to the game. It's not adding fun or humor in ways that I think most people experience. So I think that's an area the game maybe could have done better, and maybe I should have been more involved and tried to look for that at the time. But I wasn't super excited about the theme. I knew the gameplay was really solid, and I had sort of, I think at the time when they were wrapping up art, I had sort of moved on to other projects and just sort of trusted them to take it from there. So, you know, I don't have a lot more to add on that.
I personally, generic space is kind of meh to me, too. So, like, I get it.
I'm with you on that. I think if it had been the City of Angels theme, I would have wanted it to be much more involved. I'd been picking the monuments in LA that we would want to include. I would have cared more about the art style. But once we chose to go away from that, I was like, okay, I'm not super excited about this theme. You guys think it's going to work. I think the name is very catchy, so I'll just like sort of trust you guys to run with it, and I'll focus on other projects.
It's probably good for your bandwidth, too, to be able to move on.
Tell me about it. You need to decide what to work on and what to care about and what to care less about and what to not care about.
Oh, totally. And what did the playtesting and development process look like for the game, since the core rules are pretty locked in?
Yeah, I mean, it was a lot of making sure the card pool was what we wanted. The costing of the cards, the abilities, I think something we regrettably could have done better with is quite a bit of the final iconography. I was playtesting with my prototype iconography. This happens all the time with publishers, right? You don't get enough time at the end of the process to have...
Oh, with the final art to actually do blind playtests and, yeah.
Not just final, like... It's really the graphic design. Like, the art is a big plus to see if people are capturing the feel of the game that you want. But the graphic design is even more important to make sure they're actually just understanding.
Yeah, I guess when I say final art, I include graphics. But yeah, like print-ready art.
Yeah, exactly. Like those near-final files to make sure the icons that you know what they mean because you drew them and wrote the rulebook actually translate into something else someone else can intuit by looking at it in the context of the game. And Space Base, I think, came up well short of what it could have been in terms of intuitive iconography, which I think makes the game feel more difficult to learn and complex than in reality it is. So, because my work on the development side, I think I'm better as a designer than I was back then. So I would probably know to pay more attention to that than I did then. And I spent, you know, the time I spent was like, I know the rules by heart. I just want to see if the balancing of the cards is right and whether this card should be in or that card should be in. And it was less, and probably should have been more so, on, hey, someone who's never played this game before, do these icons intuitively explain to that person what they should be meaning?
I mean, I think that's a great learning lesson.
I still get this stuff wrong, right? One of my games that came out recently this year, Unstoppable, had so many rules questions pop up on BoardGameGeek still. You know, the game's done great. It's got, you know, it makes me feel good at least that, like, a lot of those the forums on BGG is someone being like, wow, I love this game so much. And then they're like, how does this rule work? And then there's, like, too many of those that I'm like, ugh.
I know. It's also hard because, like, edge cases that, like, rarely come up. So I've had that happen in many games I've developed. And I'm like, all right, we should just include it. But when it's, like, a really light game, it's like, is it worth making this rulebook heavier to put this really small edge case? But it typically does probably matter. Put an FAQ section.
Totally. You want like a QR scanner next to like you want it. You want like in your rulebook a very simple, straightforward rulebook that you just be able to play. And then like in the section where you need more, you're like, scan this QR code for FAQs on this section of the rules, right? I read this interesting like PhD dissertation on writing rulebooks. And the conclusion was they're like, there is no good way to write a rulebook.
Oh, perfect. Great.
Like, it is actually impossible to write a good rulebook.
Oh, no. That's so sad. I feel like I have some pretty solid rulebooks for a decent amount of my games, but I didn't do all of them. So I'm more of a control freak, I think, than you are, though.
Maybe. Yeah. Yeah. I'm usually content to write the first draft and then let other people polish it from there and finish the rule book.
Yeah, I'm totally good with that. I just also like being in charge of like a little bit of the layout and the graphics and just giving feedback there too. I have a graphic design degree and a psychology degree. So those are my adult-ish degrees. So I very much am interested in icons and trying to make rule books easier to look at with like visual examples and stuff. So I like to be involved in that part of it. But I am not the best writer, so I love someone else like making my writing sound better.
Okay, got it, yeah.
So how long do you think it took from that initial inspiration after playing Machikoro to having the game come out as Space Base and people able to play it?
It was a way shorter timeline than most of my experience has been with games, partly because that development process was just so quick. And partly because...
You found your publisher immediately, too?
Yeah, I immediately had my publisher. Like, literally, the week that I had made my alpha prototype, the design was done from a rules standpoint, and the publisher was already on board, right? Obviously, that cuts a lot of time out. There was no phase of me, like, working on the game on my own, and then getting to a place where I'm happy with it, and then polishing it up, and then pitching it. Like, all that was skipped. I think it was within, like, 18 months of initial idea to, like, printed copies being sold. I think it was like BGG 1 year, and then it was out two springs later, May of 2 years later. BGG is in November. By the next November, they were printing the copies at the manufacturer, and then they were on sale by the May after that.
Wow, yeah, that's pretty fast, especially for like a strategy game.
Yeah, I mean, it came out in 2018 and we're in 2025. It's still selling well.
I mean, and it's still doing really well. I would say this is an evergreen. Would you agree?
It hasn't tailed off too much. It sort of reached a stable sales point. Board Game Arena also really sort of gave it a boost. The implementation on there plays really snappy and smooth. For a while, at least, it was one of the top games played on there. Which is always, you know, as a designer, we conceptually know that our games are being played out in the wild, right? And, like, that's cool to be like, okay, people I've never met before are playing my game a bunch, and they're having a good time, and it's bringing joy to them. But we conceptually understand. We don't actually have, like, the data. But Board Game Arena and digital games, I guess, in general, but in my experience, Board Game Arena, you have the data, right? I can be like, wow, okay, it's been played 4 million times. Like, that's pretty cool, you know?
I have such mixed feelings about Board Game Arena as a designer, because you, like, run the risk when you put it on there that people will start reviewing your game based off of that and not the physical, and that it might tank your, like, board game geek status or, like, rating or whatever. And so, I don't know, I'm always, like, a little worried about it.
Yeah, I mean, that's a risk for a game where Board Game Arena is being used as a marketing device or it's a new game, and you're trying to use that as a way to demo the game to people who will then hopefully buy it. Because that digital experience is just not the same as the tabletop experience. And for some games, that it's fine. It works just as well, better, only slightly worse. But for some games, it's like, no, it's actually quite a bit less fun digitally than around a table with your friends.
Oh, totally. I do like it for the games that have giant amounts of setup where it takes like 30 minutes to set up the game. And it's like, click a button, set up, perfect, done, let's go.
Yeah, especially if it's one of those games where you're like, you're spending the whole game heads down min-maxing your own setup anyway.
Mm-hmm, exactly. I'm here for that. Or if, you know, you want to play with your friends that live in other countries or cities or states or whatever. Or across the town and you just don't want to drive. That's cool. And so then for Space Base, did you have a favorite and a least favorite experience from the design and development of the game?
I met up with John Zinzer, I think it was Nicholas from AG also, and maybe one other person. There was at least three of us. Maybe there was four of us. And we met up at Game House, which is a now sadly non-existent game cafe in LA. We met up there and we played Space Base. And we played a game, and I won using a particular strategy, and the other guys at the table were like, oh man, that strategy just seems dominant. Like, that's just such a good strategy. These other strategies don't seem strong enough. I was like, I think they are. I think it's been feeling balanced to me. And they're like, no, there's no way. And I was like, all right, let's play again. And then I played, picked one of the other strategies, and won again.
You're just better.
and then they're like, okay, all right, so that one seems good. But this, what about this third strategy? That seems kind of weak. And then we played a third time, and I won with that strategy.
Oh, my God.
it was fun. I think it's like, it points to a thing in design that, as designers, we have to be careful of in our strategy games, where certain strategies are balanced when everyone is good at the game. But they are not balanced when people are new or if there's an imbalance in player skill. Like, some strategies are easier to be good at. Some strategies benefit or require other players to actually know what they're doing in order to work. That's not the case in Space Base because it's a very multiplayer solitaire game. But there are just some strategies that you have to kind of know the card pool to know, like, okay, now that I've bought these two cards, I need to be looking for those type of cards. Whereas if you're new to the game, you're like, you don't even know those other cards exist, right? So you're not necessarily looking out for them. But this was a fun demonstration of being like, no, I think I've got it balanced. It seems to be working. In the end, I think, now that I look back on that, one of the strategies I played and won, and it was like, see, it works, has become one of the strategies that most people think is weak and underpowered. I think it falls into that category of, it is more of a niche strategy that you need to know the card pool well, and you need to time choosing that strategy correct, like, well. Like, you can't just, like, at the beginning of the game be like, I'm gonna do that strategy no matter what. Like, if the cards come out at the right time, you can make it work, and it's just as good as anything else, maybe better under the right circumstances. But new players can almost never win it. So then it creates this sort of meta in the game where that's not the strategy to go for, and no one goes for it amongst people who have played a bit but maybe aren't experts at the game. Anyway, I think that's the one that comes to mind.
And did you have, like, a least favorite experience in either the design or developing?
I don't think so. It was a pretty smooth experience. Maybe my least favorite experience was at the end of the process discovering that the rule book we had written was confusing people really badly.
That would count. That would definitely count.
like the game had come out, and like there's these icon. There's this icon in the game. They're called charges, and they're abilities that, like, when your reward for rolling this card is not to do the ability yet, it's to put a token on the card. It's that, like, that's what your reward for getting, for rolling the card is. Put a token on the card and then spend that token when appropriate at some point in the future to do some special power. And that concept was just, like, really struggling for people. It clearly wasn't explained well enough in the rulebook. In particular, one card effect that, like, the benefit is when you roll it, put the token on it. On some future roll, you can spend the token to modify the die roll. And man, people just couldn't figure that out. They were, like, convinced that, like, when you roll that card, you immediately modify the die roll that you just got the reward from for that card. That was, like, the big frustration when the game first came out, was, like, answering forums and, like, how do we fix this rule book for the next print run? Because people are like, we really like the game, but these card effects are ignoring. When these cards come up, we just set them aside because we don't know how they work. And I'm like, ah, those cards are... Those cards are fun. They're good.
I'm not going to lie. As a gamer, I've definitely set cards aside.
Yeah, you're just like, I don't know what this does, and I don't want to spend the time
figuring it out. That, and I have a massive phobia of snakes. So if it's like a game that has animals, I literally will remove, like, my friend will remove all of them. And so I'm pretty sure that maybe breaks a few games.
What is that phobia called? There's got to be a name for it, right?
No, it does. Yeah. Why am I blanking on it? I'm recording right now, and it's midnight, and I'm concussed. So I'm going to say, I'm going to blame it on both of these things.
That's funny. So a snake picture comes up and you're just like, nope.
No, I literally couldn't even say the word snake until a few years ago when I started dating someone who had 3 snake tattoos. It was a special kind of getting over it. My family used to call them schnubblies.
Interesting.
Yeah, that was the made up name my sister came up with.
That's an intense phobia you had.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I grew up in Arizona, so I've stepped on a handful. I've gotten bit by one. I've had one fall on me. I've gone swimming and they were in there. So it's like, I'm convinced that's how I'm dying. So I'm not gonna go to, like, Australia again or anywhere that's got the real poisonous ones.
Yeah. Fortunately, in California, we only have one dangerous snake, just the rattler. He warns you when he's there. So
oh yeah, no, my dad had a friend die by a diamondback bite, so every time I look at our baseball team, I'm like, why is this our mascot? But I guess most mascots are, like, terrifying animals. Like, this one can kill you, so nailed it.
Yeah, tigers used to kill people too.
There you go. Right?
But they make a good mascot.
And they also make a great mascot for cereal. So for Space Base, what was your biggest takeaway from the experience, especially since it apparently was almost perfect to begin with, rule-wise?
Sure. I mean, I think for new designers, and this is just a general piece of advice, but I think Space Base makes a good example of it. If you're looking to sort of practice your design skills or try something, I think a good, reasonable, interesting approach is to pick a game that you really respect, but don't like personally, not because it's a bad game necessarily, it's just not for you. But you're like, man, this game is so almost good for me, but it just isn't there. And then sort of dissect why, right? What you think about that game isn't scratching your itch as a gamer that maybe could if it was done differently. See if that turns into an interesting game. My other advice in that exact same context, though, is if your game does become a hit, make sure to give credit to the thing that inspired you. One thing that I didn't used to be good at, and I've learned to try to do better at, is to sort of call out the games that have inspired a particular design of mine or informed decisions in it. This sort of symbiotic relationship of all us designers is happening all the time, right? We're all creating things that inspire each other's ideas and then riffing off other people's ideas. As a designer who now has enough stuff out there that other people are being inspired by my designs, I have zero problem with that. Like, it's a compliment. Like, that's cool if I'm inspiring your designs. But it's always nice to get the credit, to be like, oh, that inspired my idea, right? Like, I'm not going to take credit for your game, right? Obviously, you made your game. You did the creative awesomeness on it. But if I inspired your awesome game in some small or meaningful way, it's always nice to get the credit. So I've tried to be much more cognizant nowadays of, even in my rule books, where it fits in the rule book, to try to put, like, a note where I thank the playtesters and stuff. I'll also try to put a little blurb in there that's like, these are the games that sort of inspired or informed aspects of this design that, you know, this design probably wouldn't be what it is or even exist at all without them.
I like doing that in, like, designer diaries, too.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, also a good spot to do it.
Yeah, no, I remember when I played your Rolling Heights game and watching how the meeples, like, how they fall, and that's how you gain, like, resources. It's like, oh, I love this idea of taking this thing that people just, like, fuss with and fidget with, and then it's actually now a mechanic. That's awesome.
Yeah, that was that one has its own inspiration path for me, where I'd always been one of those fidgeters, and for a long time I was like, man, a dice, I need to make a game where you just, like, chuck meeples and that is, like, the part of the game. And then there was a local game designer in LA who brought to a playtest thing his meeple chucking game, and I was like, this is so great, dude, make this game, what a good idea. And then I went and worked on my own games on the side for a few months, and it was like 6 months later I had this idea, and I was like, because his idea had put, like, meeples back top of mind for me, I was like, wait a second, this could have meeple rolling in it. The symbiotic relationship of designers, right? I mean, my game is nothing like his game, other than the fact that during the game you roll meeples.
It brought it to your brain again, and it inspired you to keep working on it. And sometimes you just, like, need it on the top of your head, because I know when I have an idea I like, I just put, like, all my energy into, like, making it versus it living in my notebook. And do you have any projects that you're allowed to talk about that are coming out that you can talk about?
I have a Kickstarter from AEG that theoretically will be up before the end of this year for a game called Mystic Lands, which is the evolution and cousin game to Mystic Veil. It wouldn't be wrong to call it Mystic Veil Second Edition, but it might be somewhat misleading since it is meaningfully different than Mystic Veil, but also meaningfully similar.
Okay, so sister cousin?
No, sister cousin. Is that what I said?
Oh, no. That's what I'm saying.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, no. I actually have cats. They are sister cousins. They both have the same dad, and their moms are sisters, and they make out. So, like, you know, they're sister cousin lovers.
There you go. We chose to call it Mystic Lands as opposed to Mystic Veil Second Edition because it's in that space of, like, it's clearly a evolution of Mystic Veil, but it's also, like, not just a second edition. So that's going to be up in before the end of the year, theoretically. I give it a 50% chance that timelines hold. I've got another, that one's from AEG. I've got another one from AEG that also will theoretically be on Kickstarter early next year called Electrify. I describe it as an explosive engine builder, and it was originally inspired by the game called Civilization A New Dawn, Sid Meier's Civilization A New Dawn from Fantasy Flight, which was the first game I'd seen that had a engine-ish building action selection mechanism where, like, you have a little tableau of, like, six actions. You pick one, do it, and then you move it all the way to the left of your tableau. And the further to the right your things are, the more powerful they are. Then the game that really popularized that was Ark Nova. So in both of those cases, that engine, that little, like, tableau action thing you're doing, is driving some other game that you're playing. Right? It's just the way that you choose the actions that you do in this other game. So Electrify has that same core action thing where you pick a thing, you do it, and then it moves all the way to the left of your board. And depending on how far to the right it was when you did it, it was more powerful. But in my game, in Electrify, the game is all about maximizing that engine to being really powerful and efficient. So if you like engine builders that become really explosive, that one is going to be launching early next year-ish. Let's see. I've got a Bloodborne expansion that I've finished designing, but likely won't be out until sometime next year. I think I've got some cool stuff I'm not allowed to talk about. I'm working on a Stormlight Archive board game, which is not secret, but also isn't like really announced yet, but it's happening. So Stormlight Archive is based on the Brandon Sanderson popular fantasy book series that is sort of same world as Mistborn as well. And we're making it's in sort of the genre of like Star Wars Rebellion and War of the Ring, where it's like a big 1v1 epic war game in this really cool IP setting. One of the things that was really important for me in that design was to make the 2v2 version of the game like a true 2v2. I think both the games I named there, in particular Rebellion, but to a lesser degree War of the Ring, are really good designs. Both of them just like scream their theme in awesomeness, right? I think the Rebellion is a little bit more modern and cleaner of a design, but both are amazing. Both do the theme really well. I prefer the Lord of the Rings theme, actually, but they're both great. But neither one does 2v2 in a way that I find satisfying. It's very much like, take the one player's stuff that it would have been and like cut it in half and then have two players play like half of a player. So for me in the Stormlight Archive game, it was really important that first of all, 1v1 works really well, but that 2v2 is like a true 2v2. You're like a team of people who are each one individually powerful. You're not like half a player. That one will theoretically also be crowdfunded at some point next year. Honestly, I think I've got some other stuff in the works that I may be not allowed to talk about.
You have so, you're like, can I? Oh, I mean, don't, just in case. But no, that sounds like you have a lot of really good stuff coming.
Yeah, and then I've got a whole mess of stuff I'm working on that does not have a timeline yet, including the most exciting thing that I've ever worked on that I'm not allowed to talk about yet.
Oh, yay. Thank you for that. Lead up is rude, first off.
Which doesn't have a timeline, doesn't have an official timeline yet, and is really, really exciting.
Thanks. Well, all right. Well, then for my last question, if you could have been the designer of a game that isn't one that you've designed, which would it be?
You had forewarned me of this question.
I did.
You know, if you gave me enough time to really think about it, I might have a different...
You had a full hour.
While talking to you.
I mean, multitask.
Not that good at that. The first thing that comes to mind, so that's the answer I'll give.
Okay.
Is the Guild of Merchant Explorers, which is...
AEG feels very much like a roll-and-righty kind of feel, except you're putting tokens.
Yeah. Designed by Matthew Dunstan and Brett Gilbert. Exactly, you're correct. It feels kind of roll-and-righty without doing any writing or rolling. So the reason why I say that game isn't because it's my favorite game. I do really like it.
No, it's a super good game.
I think it's fantastic. But the reason I say that is because it just falls into that category of design where I'm like, I wish I could do this as a designer. Like I wish I'd thought of this game. And if I had thought of this game, I wouldn't have designed it this well. Like, it's not in my wheelhouse to design a game like that. But I love that kind of game so much that I'm like playing that game. I'm like, I wish this was in my design skill range, and maybe one day it will be if I continue to try to stretch my design skill range. It just doesn't, like, that kind of design doesn't come naturally to me, and I wish it did. The first time I played it, I was like, I wish I'd designed this game. This is like, I would be so proud of this design. And there's other games that, like, I like, some more, some less, but that I also feel are amazing games, but they don't just sort of like perfectly fit that, like, I think this is amazing, and I don't think I could do it, right? Like, there's other games where I'm like, I think this is amazing, and I wish I'd thought of it, because I think I could have done it.
Yeah, no, I feel that, yeah.
And there's other games where I'm like, I think this is amazing, and there's no way I could have done it, and I wouldn't really want to work on it, even if I think it's great. It's just not the thing I'd be excited to work on. Whereas, like, Guild is like, I wish I'd had the idea, because I would have loved to make this game, and I just don't think I would have done it, like, I wouldn't have done it justice like it was done, right? Like, I would have had some kind of similar core idea and then taken it in some totally wrong direction and made, like, a decent game and not a great game.
Yeah, no, I like that answer. Honestly, there are definite times where I'm like, crap, I wish I could have come up with it. Like, when Just One came out and everyone's just like, oh, this was so obvious. It was like, fuck, I could have made this.
See, that's a good example of, like, a game that doesn't quite do that for me, because, like, I also played Just One, and I'm like, this is so dumb and obvious.
Yeah, it is that, yes.
This is so dumb and obvious, and it's so great, and I never would have thought of it, and I kind of wish I could be the person too, but also this game doesn't inspire me, right? Like, I think it's brilliant. I think it's genius. I think it's so dumb and obvious that you're like, oh, why didn't I think of this? But also, like, no, I know why I didn't think of it, because it's not my kind of game. You know, like, yeah. I think, like, Codenames falls into that category, too, where I'm like, this is so brilliant and so not something I would have chosen to work on. Whereas Guild is like, if Guild of Merchant Explorers, if I'd thought of that idea, I would have been super stoked to make it and work on it. And I just, like, wish I could, but I can't. I didn't and I can't.
Well, next time you'll make the next Merchant of Space. No, I'm just kidding.
I hope they lean into that design more, though. Like, other editions of that game would be great.
Oh, I would play it, for sure.
The space version of that game would be awesome.
Yeah, I mean, the core mechanisms are definitely easy.
Yeah, I just thought of another game.
You can have one more.
War Chest. War Chest is my favorite two-player game of all time that's like a boxed board game. I think Magic the Gathering probably falls into my favorite two-player all time. War Chest, it's so elegant. I've designed with my son a fantasy expansion for it that I want to talk the designers and AEG into publishing. And yes, that is one that, like, I actually think I could have designed a pretty cool similar game. I wouldn't have designed that exact game. I probably would have made it more complicated than it should have been and a little bit worse. But that game, that one's awesome. I love that design.
I'm not going to lie. I typed and searched it because I hadn't heard of it before. So you are definitely a fanboy. Only exclusively plays AEG games. You heard it here. No, I'm just kidding. Yeah. Well, I super appreciate everyone who's been listening to this episode of Game Design Unboxed, Inspiration to Publication, episode 126, Space Space. And, you know, John, thanks for being on the show. If anyone's trying to find you online, is there anywhere you want people to follow your designs?
I have made myself hard to follow by eliminating social media from my life as much as possible. I'm off Twitter. I'm essentially off Facebook. So the place to follow me would be just to follow my games on Board Game Geek or when a company announces it. I don't do much self-promotion anymore on social media.
All right.
That's not the answer I'm supposed to give, but it's
truth. It's you probably are doing a lot more fun stuff without a screen.
I have too many children to be spending time on social media anymore.
No, that's totally fair. Wait, how many kids do you have?
Only four.
That's a lot of kids. I mean, I would say right now it's hard to afford four kids.
Yeah, only four.
Yeah, especially if you live in LA. Like, what?
Yeah. We get by. We're homeschooling them too, so that adds to the experience. But it's good. There's nothing like having kids.
I have three cats, so I could not say, but I believe you. I'm perfect. So yeah, I'm your local cat lady who's the host of this show, Danielle Reynolds.
I have a fond appreciation of cat ladies, so.
Oh, good. Oh, because of the AEG game?
No.
I thought this was another joke. I was like, okay, we're doing
I do like that game. I grew up with a cat. I like cats. My sister has a cat.
Aw, cute. Love it. Yeah, and I have too many social media accounts, and they're all under Token Gamer, like GAYMER. Or I also now have it for Game Design Unboxed, so I might ask you to be on it at some point, because I've been posting some fun videos on Instagram and TikTok just about game design and just like 1-minute versions of what we just recorded in an hour. So, yeah.
Cool. Well, you're a joy to talk with, so I would happily join for others if invited.
Heck yeah, you heard it here. He likes me. Well, thanks for being on the show. This is great. I hope everyone had fun with Space Space.
Thanks, listeners. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you for joining Danielle for another episode of Game Design Unboxed, Inspiration to Publication. If you'd like to hear more great gaming podcasts, check out NoDirectionPodcasts.com. And if you're looking for a great board game, bag, playmat, or table, check out AllPlay at Let'sAllPlay.com. Join us next time.